make a bargain with a god. Gold was not a treasure, this Tawfari knew. Gold was like all capital, in that it had no memory. Its drift was always onward, away from the past.
All right, but you'll shake, won't you?
Balfour seized Tawfari's dry hand in his wet one and shook it vigorously.
There's a good man, Ted. There's a good man.
But Tawfari was still looking severely displeased, and he withdrew his hand from Balfour's grip as soon as he was able. Balfour felt a twinge of regret. It would not do to make an enemy of the fellow, not with so much of this business yet unsolved, he thought. There was a chance that he knew something about the relations, whatever they were, between Crosby Wells and Francis Carver, or between those two men and Lauderback, come to think of it. Yes, it would be useful to keep the man appeased. Balfour reached into his pocket. Surely he had something small, some token. They were fond of tokens. His fingers found a shilling and a sixpence. He pulled the sixpence out.
Here, he said. You can have this, if you tell me some Maori. Just like you taught Crosby Wells, hey, Ted? Then we'll have done business just as you wanted to. All right? Then we'll be friends. Then you won't be able to complain.
He pressed the silver piece into the other man's palm. Tawfari looked at it.
Now tell me, said Balfour, rubbing his hands together. What does hokitika mean? Hokitika. Just the one word, that's all I'm after.
And I'd call that a tidy price, by the by. A sixpence for a single word? I'd call that a song.
Te Rau Tawfari sighed. Hokitika. He knew the sense of it, but could not translate. This happened so often between the languages, English and Maori. The words of one tongue never found their exact equivalent in the other, just as there was no white man's herb that one might perfectly exchange for puha, and no white man's bread that exactly called to mind rewena pararoa. However close the flavour, there was always something approximated, something imagined, or something lost. Crosby Wells had understood this. Te Rau Tawfari taught him korero Maori without using any English at all. They used their fingers to point and their faces to mimic, and when Te Rau said things that Crosby Wells did not understand, he let the sounds wash over him like prayers until their meanings clarified and he could see inside the word.
Hokitika, said Balfour.
He wiped the rain from his face.
Come on, mate!
At last Tawfari lifted his finger and described a circle in the air. When his fingertip returned to the place from which he had begun, he jabbed his finger sharply to mark the place of return. But one cannot mark a place upon a circle, he thought. To mark a place upon a circle is to break it, so that it is not a circle any longer.
Understand it like this, he said,
regretting that he had to speak the words in English and approximate the noun.
Around, and then back again, beginning.
The Reserve Bank was always very crowded on a Saturday at noon. Diggers stood about with their hands full of gold. The Libra scales rattled up and down as the ore was measured and recorded. The junior bankers ran back and forth from the archives, checking claim papers, marking tax payments, and receiving fees. Along the wall that faced the street were four barred cubicles where the bankers sat. Above them hung a gilt-framed chalkboard, upon which was written that week's yield in ore, with subtotals for each district, and a grand total for the Hokitika region as a whole. Whenever a sum of raw gold was banked or bought, the chalked numbers were erased and then totaled anew, typically to a murmur of appreciation from the men in the room, and occasionally, if the total was a remarkable one, to a round of applause. When Balfour entered the bank, the attention of the crowd was focused not upon this chalkboard, but upon the long table opposite, where the gold buyers, identifiable by the bright copper satchels that they wore upon their belts, inspected the raw ore for purchase. The buyer's work was slow. He weighed each nugget in his hand, scratched and tested the metal for impurities, and examined it through a jeweler's loop. If the ore had been sifted, he filtered it through sieves of matting to check the flakes had not been cut with grit or gravel, and sometimes shook glistering handfuls over plates of mercury to ensure that the metals bonded as they should. Once he declared the stuff pure and fit to be valued, the digger in question shuffled forward and was asked to state his name. The Libra scales were then calibrated until the arm hung parallel with the desk, and then the buyer poured the digger's pile of gold into the left-hand tray. To the right-hand tray, the buyer added cylinder weights, one by one, until finally the scales lurched and the tray bearing the man's fortune shuddered and swung free. That morning, there was only one buyer present. A slick-haired magnate wearing a pale green hunting jacket and a yellow tie. A gaudy combination, and one that might have served to mark him rather too obviously as a moneyed man, had he been doing business alone and unprotected. But the Hokitika Gold Escort was on hand. This small army, a uniformed infantry of 10 men, presided over every sale and purchase of the colour. Later they would oversee the bullion's transfer into an armoured van and ensure that it was safely conveyed offshore. They stood behind the buyer and flanked the desk at which he sat, each man armed with a 577 Snyder Enfield rifle, a massive, gleaming piece of the most modern design. It took a cartridge as long as a man's index finger and could blow a fellow's head to bloody dust. Balfour admired the Snyder Enfield when the model was first shipped in, but seeing 10 armed men in this enclosed space gave him an anxious premonition. The room was so crowded he doubted any one guard could find the room to raise his weapon to his shoulder, let alone discharge a round. He shouldered his way through the diggers to the banker's cubicles. Most of the men in the room were present as spectators only, and so parted to admit him. It was in very little time at all, therefore, that Balfour found himself at a barred cubicle, facing a young man in a striped vest and a neatly pinned cravat.
"Good morning. I'm wanting to know if a man named Francis Carver has ever taken out a miner's right in New Zealand," Balfour said. He removed his hat and slicked back his wet hair, an action without a perceptible benefit, for the palm of his hand was very wet also.
"Francis Carver? A captain, Carver?"
"That's the man," said Balfour.
"I'm obliged to ask who you are, and why you are requesting this information."
The banker spoke without effect, and in a mild tone of voice.
"The man owns a ship, and I'm in the shipping trade," Balfour said smoothly, replacing his hat. "Tom Balfour's my name. I'm looking to set up a side venture of a kind. Tea trading, back and forth from Canton. Just canvassing the idea at this point. I want to find out a bit more about Carver before I make any offers of business. Where his money spread, whether he's ever been bankrupted, that kind of thing."
"Surely you could just ask Mr. Carver yourself," replied